From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with two men at the forefront of a movement to reintegrate politics and religion in a way that isn't oppressive or intolerant. Michael Lerner is part of the Jewish Renewal Movement and editor of Tikkun magazine. His notion of a politics of meaning has influenced the Clintons. Jim Wallace is an evangelical Christian and founder of Sojourners magazine. Also today, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Dutch cellist Peter Vispelvay's new recording of Vivaldi cello sonatas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Anne Bozell. More violence in Port-au-Prince, Haiti today, where a grenade was thrown into a crowd of supporters of exiled President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. NPR's Suni Khalid has more from Port-au-Prince.
Witnesses told us that there was a demonstration of several thousand Aristide supporters. And what happened was that a grenade was tossed into the crowd. Haitian radio is reporting that at least three are dead and 20 are injured. We went to the general hospital here in Port-au-Prince, and we talked to one of the doctors, and they have a press conference later today, is that they were receiving several people in with injuries from the explosion. Witnesses told us that U.S. Army arrested a lieutenant in the Haitian police, Lieutenant Bernard, and arrested him in connection with the grenade being thrown.
NPR's Suni Khalid. The incident took place not far from an American troop position, but no Americans were injured. The explosion occurred about a mile from City Hall, where Mayor Evans Paul had just been welcomed home by thousands of well-wishers. He had been in hiding for much of the 3 years since President Aristide was overthrown. Earlier today, Secretary of State Warren Christopher appealed to the international community to join in the economic reconstruction of Haiti. Christopher made his remarks during a speech to the United Nations Security Council. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Christopher told the council there are now almost 16,000 U.S. troops in Haiti and that the operation is moving swiftly to establish a safe and stable environment. Virtually at the same time he was speaking, Port-au-Prince Mayor Evans Paul was escorted into City Hall under heavy U.S. guard. The council is expected to adopt a resolution that lifts U.N. economic sanctions on Haiti. The lifting wouldn't take effect until one day after Aristide returns, which is not expected until the middle of next month. However, Christopher said the international community must also do its part to rebuild the country and provide economic and humanitarian aid. While the U.S. operation in Haiti was praised by other speakers, Brazil's foreign minister was critical, saying the presence of foreign forces in a Latin American country was a disturbing precedent. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
Rescuers say they may never know how many people died when an Estonian ferry boat sank this week. The current death toll is 909, but the Finnish official in charge of rescue operations says the final numbers may remain incomplete because some people on the ferry were not on the passenger list. 140 people survived. Meanwhile, officials say any salvage operation will have to wait until next year because of the cold weather. Investigators plan to use a robot to examine the wreck and locate bodies, but were unable to do that today because of rough weather. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are down 23 points at 38.55. This is NPR News in Washington. Citing strong local opposition, which threatened to hurt its corporate image, the Walt Disney Company announced it is abandoning plans to build a theme park just miles from the site of a Civil War battlefield. Last November, Disney announced plans to build the $625 million park 6 miles from the Manassas National Battlefield Park in rural Virginia, about 35 miles from Washington, D.C. Historians, environmentalists, and some local citizens vigorously opposed the move. And although Disney had the support of the local and state governments, it said it will look elsewhere for a site. The Pan American Health Organization today declared victory in its war on polio in the Americas. NPR's Joe Palca has more.
In 1985, health officials decided it was time to wipe out polio in the Americas. An effective vaccine was available. What was needed was a major effort to get the vaccine to everyone who needed it. The Pan American Health Organization organized National Vaccine Days, where nearly every child under five in countries throughout South and Central America would get immunized in one day. Health officials then began extensive surveillance efforts to spot any cases of polio that might crop up. Now that work has paid off. The last recorded case of polio in the Americas was August 23, 1991, in Peru. Health officials say the polio virus has now been eradicated from the Western Hemisphere. But they warn that it hasn't been eradicated everywhere in the world, so every child still needs to be vaccinated against the disease. This is Joe Palca in Washington.
The Delhi government has closed schools and movie theaters in the Indian capital to help check the spread of plague. The number of cases continues to escalate, with more than 1,500 people suspected of having the disease. 54 have died. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization said today it expects the epidemic to run its course in about 3 weeks. I'm Ann Bozell, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Michael Lerner wants religion to have a place in American political debate, but he thinks that place is disproportionately represented by the religious right. Lerner is the editor of Tikkun magazine, which offers a Jewish critique of politics, culture, and society. Lerner coined the expression the politics of meaning to describe an alternative to our current politics of greed, materialism, and self-promotion. Lerner says he's trying to reclaim Judaism from the conservatives, the conformists, and the spiritually obtuse. He continues that effort in his new book, Jewish Renewal. He's investigated why so many young Jewish people have virtually left their religion. He did a survey of over 350 people who drifted away from Judaism. Here's what he found.
Well, they told me that it had a great deal to do with the materialism that they experienced in the Jewish world, the lack of spirituality, the insensitivity, actually, to spiritual questions, the focus on selfishness, in this case, the selfishness of Jews focusing on their own survival without regard to the consequences for others. It was totally understandable, of course, given our history, why that would have happened, particularly after the Holocaust. But nevertheless, growing up in America, to be part of a community that seemed to only be asking the question of what was in Jewish interests was very hard for many people to take. Then there was the sexism and homophobia in the Jewish world, and there was a general sense that one's deepest spiritual issues were not being addressed. So ironically, people left the Jewish world not because it was too hard to be different from American society. That's what the Jewish establishment often says, is that Jews ran away because it's so hard to be Jewish. But actually, from my the information that I got in this survey, I found that people ran away because Jewish society was too much like American society. It had adopted too much of the materialism and the selfishness, the self-centeredness, the lack of spiritual sensitivity.
Well, I think there was a period, I think maybe that period doesn't exist anymore, but there was a period when a lot of young Jewish people were looking for spirituality in Buddhism or other seemingly more exotic forms of faith.
Right. People went to other religious communities, or they went to progressive politics as a way to find a community that took ethical values seriously. Or else, many simply said, this whole notion of living a spiritual life is impossible because here our example of the Jewish world where we're supposed to learn spirituality actually is dominated by the people who have the most money and the most economic and political power in the society. So that's impossible, and hence they gave up altogether and went into a materialist life. Ironically, in their absence of a spiritual alternative being provided in the Jewish world led them to go back into a very materialist world. So it wasn't that everybody went towards an alternative spirituality. Some people simply rejected Judaism and went towards the dominant ethos of American society.
You were saying before that you found that a lot of young Jewish people tried to find spirituality in other religions because they didn't feel that they could find it in the Judaism that they were familiar with. You're part of what's called the Jewish Renewal Movement. Do you almost see that as a way of finding that spirituality in your own faith instead of looking elsewhere?
Absolutely. Judaism has a tremendous resources of spirituality, but those resources have been largely abandoned, in part by the trauma of Jewish history. It's hard to stay true to a God that is projected in the Bible that tells us that it is possible to fundamentally transform the world, change it to make it more ethically and spiritually alive. It's very hard to stay in contact with that God when bringing that message to the world has generated so much anger from ruling elites who have been furious that Jews keep saying that the world can be fundamentally transformed. Because they get furious at us, they have stirred up native populations against us all through our history. And as a result, Jews are a very disparaged and attacked group. So Jews want to run away from that, and yet there is in Torah and in the Jewish tradition a tremendous wealth of exciting spiritual insight.
I think a lot of people who were alienated from or disenchanted with their religion and have returned to it and seek a new, deeper spirituality there are also often looking for new rituals or new prayers which communicate the way they see the world. And for a lot of people, it's because they feel that some of the old prayers were sexist or homophobic or whatever. But I'm wondering how you feel about new rituals and new prayers, whether you look more to the past or whether you're comfortable with creating new rituals to describe more contemporary sentiments.
I think we need both. There's an incredible amount of wisdom in the Jewish tradition, and I'm very reluctant to throw out that wisdom that's been built up over the course of 3,500 years simply because it doesn't immediately speak to us. And I think we have to reclaim within those traditions a great deal of that wisdom and find it there. And I have found it there, for example, in the way that the Sabbath is structured. With all of the rigid rules around the Sabbath, I've found it to be precisely because of the ways that it keeps us away from the rhythms of the rest of the week. It has created an incredibly deep spiritual space for me and for many other people. On the other hand, I also think that there are elements of the Jewish tradition that do embody sexism and homophobia or an outdated view of God as a kind of patriarch sitting in heaven and dispensing good or evil depending on whether we please him, her, whatever. That, I think, has to be transcended and has to be changed. I don't think that we can any longer think of God as sitting there waiting for us to deliver the best smells like the best food like the sacrifices in the ancient temple. There was a time when we thought that what God really wanted was a yummy piece of lamb chop, and so we presented God with the various sacrifices. In a later period, after the temple was destroyed 2,000 years ago, we came to think that what God really wanted was a bunch of correctly said prayers. And so we tried to present those prayers. I think this whole image of God is wrong. And I don't think we can think of God in those terms. And I think we need new language and new ritual that can speak to our contemporary understandings.
So you use a combination of the two, the old rituals and new prayers.
Exactly. And I think that even when I sometimes reject older prayers, I think it's worthwhile to re-understand the mindsets that people were in previous historical moments, if only to be able to transcend them.
Tell us what your typical Sabbath is like now.
Well, it includes, first of all, 25 hours of exclusion from the world of work. I mean, no telephones, no writing, no using money, no buying and spending, no creating of anything connected with power over. The Sabbath is a unique moment to relate to the world, relate to the physical world from the standpoint of awe and wonder and celebration rather than from the standpoint of domination. So virtually everything that is connected with the power that we normally have over the world, I try to avoid. And instead join with other people on Friday night in a ritual meal, singing, storytelling, and the next day with a prayer service in the morning, and again in the afternoon, a time to reflect, to read, often to commune with nature. lots of good food, good sex are part of this the tradition.
Good sex part of the Sabbath?
Yeah, it's actually an injunction for married people to have sex on Sabbath, because the Sabbath is not meant to be an affliction. It's meant to be pleasure.
What if you're not married?
There's no such injunction. You're not required to have sex.
No, you strike me as a pretty hardworking, achievement-oriented guy. You've got a magazine to put out. Say you're crashing on a deadline and it's the Sabbath. Will you ever violate any of your rules to save your magazine?
Well, I love Tikkun, and I think we're doing a great service to God by in the work of Tikkun, but absolutely not. In other words, it wouldn't be serving God to protect the magazine at the expense of undermining the sacredness of the Sabbath. The Sabbath is really a lifesaver for me, and I think for anyone who takes it seriously. For anybody who gets into those 25 hours in a serious way, it provides the spiritual nourishment that makes possible all the rest. So I absolutely don't do it, and when people frequently approach me in synagogue trying to hand me manuscripts to consider for the magazine, I say, not this Sabbath. I don't want to talk about the world of work. This is a moment for a different logic and a different way of being.
My guest is Michael Lerner. His new book is called Jewish Renewal. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Back with Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine, a magazine offering a Jewish critique of politics and culture. You're both a very religious and a very political person, and those two come together for you in your life. In America, I think, you know, in the past few years, the most organized religious group in the political arena has been fundamentalists and the religious right. And I wonder what role you see for people who are more on the left, like yourself, and who are religious, playing in the political world.
Well, I think it's very important for people with religious ideals to articulate those ideals in the political arena. I don't think that the problem with the religious right is that religion has no business being in the political arena. The problem with the religious right is that it's a religious vision that I think is offensive to anybody who recognizes that every human being is created in the image of God. And to the extent that that vision doesn't, it ought to be challenged. But there is a liberal notion that sort of says, if you allow any religion in there, you're never going to be able to stop the religious right. And so we should try to keep all of the religious views outside of the political realm. The problem with that view is that it fails to notice that the religious right is already in the political realm, and the people who don't have their religious or ethical values being argued for are the liberals and progressives. They think that they can keep the political arena neutral by refusing to argue for their highest ethical values in the political arena. But the result of that is not that the political arena stays ethically or religiously neutral. It's that the wrong people's ethical and religious views get articulated there, and nobody else gets a chance to articulate an alternative vision.
Although you disagree with the politics of the religious right, you've said that you want to really understand the legitimate needs that the religious right is addressing in America.
Exactly.
I wonder what conclusions you've reached about that.
Well, you see, from my standpoint, we live in a society which does not take the spiritual realm seriously, and which does not take people's spiritual and ethical needs seriously. And instead, it says, well, this has nothing to do with politics. And people in their daily life find that their life is extremely frustrating because it's based so much on the principle of self-interest. The dominant value of American society is take care of number one. Look out for number one. This was the name of one of the big bestsellers of the 80s, along with Winning Through Intimidation. And what happens is people experience the world of work, the economy, and then their own personal lives is so much based on that value that they find themselves isolated, not able to trust other people. Relationships are very hard to sustain because everybody thinks, well, if I don't take care of myself, nobody else will, so I'd better just watch out for myself and not be paying so much attention to the needs of others. In this context, where there's a huge spiritual crisis, the religious right comes forward and says, hey, we need a different set of values. We need values that value human beings, that value relationship, that value commitment, that value spirituality. And I think that they are right to a great extent in noticing that this is a big problem. The only problem is that they then come forward with a spiritual or ethical view that demeans somebody else, that blames these problems on some demeanable other, whether that be blacks or gays or feminists or liberals. They take they find some other to demean, but they are articulating a real problem. And I think that this is the great problem for the liberals, is that they don't understand that when people are moving to the right, they're often moving to the right for legitimate needs, for a legitimate desire for some kind of ethical and spiritual worldview that the liberals think is inappropriate for politics.
Now, I know you really want to have some kind of impact on political thought in America. And one way that you've done that is influencing something Hillary Clinton has said. I think it was in an April 1993 speech. She said a few things that referred to your thoughts on the politics of meaning. And do you want to paraphrase what it is she said, and then my question?
she said very explicitly that that this society needs a new politics of meaning, and that this society has learned to value money, but it hasn't learned to value values. And so we need a different kind of ethos in the society. And I think she came very close to saying exactly what the politics of meaning was about. And of course, Bill Clinton had written to me several years before to say that he had been reading Tikkun magazine on a regular basis, and that the politics of meaning we were talking about made a great deal of sense to him.
It must be very seductive to know that a president and first lady are not only reading you, but taking your thoughts very seriously, and in Hillary's case, even quoting from those ideas. And yet, as a journalist, it's part of your job in Tikkun to constantly look dispassionately on the president and the first lady's performance and criticize them. And I'm wondering if it's been hard for you to be very critical after establishing some kind of relationship with them. I mean, how seductive is that?
Well, let me say two things. Number one, as far as I'm concerned, the Clintons, after they articulated the politics of meaning, have gone very far away from actually living up to the politics of meaning, and we've said that very consistently in Tikkun magazine. We've been very critical of the distance that they've traveled and their failure to shape a program that actually flows from this, what should be the central goal of an administration in this period, which is to change the dominant ethos of American society from an ethos of selfishness to an ethos of caring. And although at times they've moved in those directions, they've neither consistently articulated that as a goal, nor have their policies flowed from that. So I've been very critical. We've been very critical of them. That's one thing. The other thing to say is, and this is related to Jewish renewal, the Jewish people have been involved in a struggle to heal and repair this world for 3,500 years. And I have no illusion that a particular president at a particular moment is going to suddenly come forward and be the embodiment of that and then go forward and do it. This is a long-term struggle. We've been involved in a long-term struggle for healing and repair for a very, very, you know, for a very long time, and will continue to be. So I'm not so impressed when a particular president says, "Yeah, he likes this language," and I don't have any delusion that I, Michael Lerner, am so important. Not at all.
Michael, let me quote something that you once wrote in Tikkun. You wrote, "Somehow Americans got it in their heads that their leaders must be on a higher level than everyone else. This insistence guarantees that our leaders are liars. They must hide who they really are." Elaborate
exactly
on that for me.
Well, it comes straight out of Jewish renewal. There were two messages that God gave. Number one is that the world can be fundamentally transformed. That was the first message of Sinai. The second message, after God saw the Jewish people building a golden calf, was, and Moses was so furious he broke the tablets and so forth, God gave a second revelation, namely that one needs to have compassion, that the world is always going to be faced with human beings who want to go for their highest ideals, but who never fully embody those ideals. And that's been the history of the Jewish people for our 3,500 years. We are not the fullest embodiment of the ideals we believe in, but it is wrong to put us down for going for those ideals. And similarly, for every person committed to changing the world, to healing or repairing the world, we are all wounded healers. We are all people who are less than our highest ideals. Now, what the media says is, aha, see, I've discovered, I can unveil the ways in which you're not really being the fullest embodiment of your ideals. But that's inevitable. Nobody is going to be that fullest embodiment of the ideals, and we need to have a great deal of compassion and caring for people and not tell them, if you can't embody your ideals fully, then forget about your ideals, just go for selfishness. But instead, be able to accept that people will not be the fullest and highest, their fullest and highest selves, and encourage them to go for their highest selves, but at the same time treat them with love and compassion and caring.
I have one last question for you. Were your parents really surprised when you so fully embraced Judaism?
Well, at first they were very astounded. They thought when I had first decided to get into it, they thought this was a really lower middle class thing to do. It was downwardly mobile.
Why would it be downwardly mobile?
Well, because if you wanted to make it an American society, you had to put your own self-interest first and not some values first. And you weren't going to make it that way. If you were going to be wealthy, you were not going to let Shabbos interfere. You certainly were not going to start talking about redistribution of wealth. You know, the Torah has this principle that every 50 years, all land gets redistributed back to an original equal redistribution. Well, talking about that sounded in the 1950s and 1960s as though this were communism, or this was some terrible political idea that would totally undermine your ability to have any credibility in American politics or American society. So the Torah has a lot of revolutionary ideas in it, and you really undermine your credibility as a political force or as an economic force if you took them seriously. But then again, Torah wasn't meant to be a guide for how to make it in American society. It was meant to be a guide for how to transform the world according to a higher view, according to a divine view of what the world could be.
But let's get back to your parents. So they were surprised.
They were very surprised, yes. And at first disappointed, and then at a later point delighted.
Disappointed because?
Disappointed because they had hoped that I would be a greater achiever, say, in the society, that I would make it more than they had. My father and mother had imagined that I was going to be a U.S. senator, the first Jewish U.S. senator from New Jersey. That was their fantasy, and it was very disappointing to them when I lost interest in political power and was more interested in articulating an ethical and spiritual view.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Michael Lerner is the editor of Tikkun magazine and author of the new book, Jewish Renewal. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Share is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jim Wallace is an evangelical Christian who doesn't align himself with the religious right. He wants to see a reintegration of politics and religion in this country in a way that transcends notions of left and right and which isn't oppressive or intolerant. Coming up, we talk with Jim Wallace, founder of Sojourners Magazine and author of the new book, The Soul of Politics. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Vivaldi cello sonatas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Bozell. At least three people were killed and dozens injured today when a grenade exploded into a crowd of Aristide supporters in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. No Americans were among the casualties. Just moments later, U.S. troops fired machine guns into a nearby building and later dragged out at least one person in handcuffs. The incident heightened concern about security at a planned rally tomorrow to mark the anniversary of the 1991 coup which ousted elected President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Meanwhile, the first contingent of international police monitors has arrived in Haiti. Raymond Kelly, the former New York City police commissioner, will head the force from 27 countries. It will total nearly 1,000 members and remain in Haiti for 6 months. Secretary of State Warren Christopher today formally introduced a resolution in the Security Council to lift all sanctions against Haiti once President Aristide is returned to power. Christopher told the Council the time has come to prepare for the resumption of normal economic activities in Haiti, and he urged the Council to continue to act together.
Our nations understand that the best way to achieve our goal is by acting together. That's what we reaffirmed. That's what we indicated so strongly when we approved Resolution 940. And that is what we do today, and that's what we must do in the months ahead.
The Council is expected to approve the legislation. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing today on several aspects of the crime bill signed by President Clinton earlier this month. The measure contains a provision which will provide extra protection for abused and battered women. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has more.
If a man is forbidden by one state to visit his wife because he has hurt her, the order ordinarily does not apply in other states if she moves. Under this new law, all states will honor such orders from any state. Senator Biden of Delaware, the main author of the bill, says other provisions should also help to reduce violence against women.
More lights, cameras, and emergency phones at bus stops, subway stations, parking lots, and public areas where 35 years ago women did not have to frequent at night.
The bill will also result in automatic charges being brought in spousal abuse cases. Women often are scared to press charges against men. Pi Chamberlain, Capitol Hill.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin is winding up a 5-day visit to the United States with a stop in the Northwest. He is in Seattle this afternoon, where he will tour the Boeing plant and meet with business and civil leaders. On Wall Street, stock prices closed down today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 23.89 points to close at 38.54.29. Trading was heavy. 302 million shares changed hands. This is NPR News in Washington. NASA is planning another shuttle launch tomorrow. Endeavour is scheduled to blast off in the morning on a 10-day environmental mission. Forecasters say there's a 70% chance of favorable weather, and NASA officials say the countdown is proceeding smoothly so far. The 6-member crew will use an advanced radar system to scan the Earth for climate variations caused by natural forces and by humans. A key senator today declared that efforts to reform the 122-year-old mining law are dead for this Congress. NPR's Philip Davis has this report.
Louisiana Senator J. Bennett Johnston, the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, said strong opposition from the mining industry killed the bill. Mining companies can now extract gold and other minerals from publicly owned land for as little as $2.50 an acre, and they don't pay any royalties on the value of the minerals and metals they've mined either. The reform proposal would have, for the first time, charged a royalty and would have made it harder for mining companies to gain permanent control over public land. Both chambers had approved mining reform bills, but the Senate and the House were not able to resolve differences between the two versions. Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt said the administration supports reform. He hinted that the administration might make some administrative changes to mining law on its own. In Washington, this is Philip Davis reporting.
The House Judiciary Committee has voted to eliminate baseball's antitrust exemption if owners unilaterally impose work rules such as a salary cap. The measure now goes to the full House for consideration. And the National Hockey League Association players say they will not strike during the coming season if management cancels plans for a lockout. Findings from a state review of Elvis Presley's medical records were released today. They find there is no evidence the coroner lied when he said Presley died of heart disease. I'm Ann Bozell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many Americans assume that all evangelical Christians identify with the religious right. Jim Wallace says that's a false assumption. He's an evangelical Christian whose priorities include fighting poverty, racism, and sexism. Although he shares many of the left's political views, he criticizes the left for failing to articulate or demonstrate the moral values that are the foundation of any strong social change movement. Wallace is a co-founder of Sojourners, a religious community that lives in the inner city of Washington, D.C., and publishes a magazine about faith, politics, and culture. I asked Wallace how his faith informs his politics and how he thinks that compares to the religious right.
The word evangelical is a wonderful word. It comes from the word evangel, which means good news. And Jesus, in his first sermon at Nazareth, which I like to call his Nazareth Manifesto, he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to preach the evangel, good news to the poor." And he talks about liberating the captives and breaking, setting free those from oppression. That's the good news. That's the evangel. Now, the religious right today is not known for preaching a message of good news to poor people. And I think the word evangelical has been so co-opted and corrupted by the religious right that we've lost the richness of its meaning and power.
Are there things that you feel you agree on politically or spiritually with evangelical Christians who are a part of the organized right?
I think the religious right has tapped into a genuine public longing for a politics that's connected to values. I think the crisis we face in this country is really a crisis of spirit. It calls for more than politics as usual or even religion as usual, for that matter. And it calls for what the Bible, my tradition, calls the healing of the nation, I think. So a politics that combines a real concern for moral values and social justice is at the heart of my concern, and I identify very much with the people who raised me and evangelical folks out there who care about moral values and about the breakdown of the culture. For example, I think we are experiencing an unraveling of the culture, its moral framework and structures. There's a kind of lack of respect on every level of this society. But we're also facing economic, political, social oppression. And the left and the right have become almost dysfunctional categories now, where the liberal left talks more about social oppression and the right talks about the breakdown of the culture. Well, I think they're both critical and they're deeply related. We have to understand how the breakdown of the culture and its sort of understanding of civility and basic respect and compassion are linked to the removal of 70,000 jobs from South Central Los Angeles, for example, before the Rodney King verdict.
I think a lot of people confuse evangelical with fundamentalist. What's the difference, and is fundamentalism a part of your faith?
Well, when I was growing up in an evangelical church, we thought of ourselves as evangelical, and we also talked about the fundamentalists who were on the right. I mean, I knew Jerry Falwell's name back in those days before he ever became a famous figure on the national level. And fundamentalism was, without going into all of his history, was a movement in reaction to liberal Protestantism in the beginning of the century. And they went back to the fundamentals of their faith. But I think it's been principally a reactive movement, a movement in reaction, whereas evangelical, in its best sense, as I said, is sort of it's a biblical faith, saying that the biblical vision is critical for us.
I think one of the reasons why a lot of Americans are skeptical of opening up the political debate to include more about religion is this. A lot of people are afraid that the more religion enters the political debate, the more it risks becoming about one particular religion, which might not be your religion. Or maybe you're not a person who is part of an organized religion and you want the freedom to remain so, and you fear that the laws of the country will begin to represent the laws of one faith.
Mm-hmm. Those are good questions, and a lot of people have those on their minds. I would just say this. The public square really is naked without spiritual values. And we have to find a way to bring spirituality into the public square in a pluralistic and democratic society that is tolerant, that is inclusive, that is respectful of differences in religion, and even where there's no religion at all, but people are hungry for this question of spiritual values. So because the religious right has created this notion that you can't do this without becoming bigots or becoming, totalitarian or theocratic, imposing our views on somebody else, it's made people afraid. It's interesting, though. People, I think, are drawn to a more spiritual notion of politics while they're at the same time afraid of religious intolerance. Both of those things I find to be true. So how do we bring spirituality into the discussion, into the political debate, in a way that is very, very respectful of a pluralistic, democratic, inclusive society? Because that's what we have now.
Let me give you an example of an issue that is very politically charged and also very controversial from a religious perspective. And I'm of course, thinking of abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Abortion goes against the faith of many people in America. Many other people in America are of a faith that allows abortion or don't belong to an organized religion and therefore believe, therefore don't have anything that prevents them mm-hmm. from being comfortable with the idea of abortion when a woman feels it is necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you, I know, are opposed to abortion. Your group Sojourners is opposed to abortion. How do you enter the public debate on that from a perspective that is both multicultural and respectful of the differences of other people's faiths on that issue, and yet that addresses your spiritual, moral concerns about abortion?
I think on an issue like abortion, for example, we really are desperately in need of finding some new middle ground. I think that people on both sides of this debate have legitimate concerns about the sacredness of human life and the vulnerability that women feel in a patriarchal society to make choices. How is gender justice going to be possible? See, Sojourners is committed both to the sacredness of human life, and we have a genuine feminist commitment. And I think we have to explore middle ground. Middle ground that doesn't criminalize desperate choices on the one hand. On the other hand, tries to create alternatives to abortion, tries to create, as I say, an agenda of justice for women, which makes abortion less and less necessary, that even discourages abortion, but offers other alternatives. So I'm not sure exactly what those formulations would be, but I'm encouraged how that there's even groups called Middle Ground forming around the country. And interestingly enough, they are women on both sides of the debate, who are talking about seeking together some common ground on these questions.
My guest is Jim Wallace, founding editor of Sojourners Magazine and author of the new book, The Soul of Politics. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jim Wallace, author of the new book, The Soul of Politics. I'm interested in how you got to the place where you are now in terms of faith and politics. Tell us something about the Christianity you grew up with.
Well, I grew up in Detroit, and you know, the home of Motown. And so I grew up, our high school dances had Diana Ross and Stevie Wonder, who we called Little Stevie Wonder back then. And which created the problem for me because in my home and family, they didn't want you to dance, and I couldn't ever listen to Motown without wanting to dance. So that was a contradiction right away with the evangelical faith I was raised in.
So dancing was against the faith?
Well, yeah, it was frowned upon.
What else was against the faith that you wanted to do as a teenager?
It was like, you know, dancing, drinking, smoking, those kinds of things. Those defined the, what people should or shouldn't do. What happened for me was, I was reared in that very middle American, middle class, evangelical, white context. And when I got to be about 14 or 15, there were some questions that just came, that arose in my own heart that wouldn't go away, which was, why do we live the way we do in white Detroit when just a few blocks, a few miles away in black Detroit, people are living very different lives? I didn't know anybody who'd ever missed a meal. I didn't know any family whose, at that point, their dad at least didn't have a job. I didn't know anybody who had any loved ones in jail, in prison. And yet I was reading in the newspapers and hearing on television that life was very different, not very far from where I live. There were people who were unemployed and hungry, and the jails were full, and I noticed how people changed, just their faces and body language, whenever the issue of the city or crime or race came up.
So were you asking yourself, why is it bad to dance, but no one's telling me that poverty is bad?
Well, those sort of the prohibitions about dancing and those things, they never fazed me much. I went out on Friday night to dance. Those things seemed like not the heart of faith to me. And when I raised these questions about things that felt more important to me than whether we danced or not, I got this kind of answer. I said, they said, you're too young to ask these questions. When you get older, you'll understand. Or, we don't know why things are that way either, but it's always been that way. And the only honest answer I got to the question was, if you keep asking these kinds of questions, you're going to get into a lot of trouble. And that proved to be true.
You left your faith for a while. I guess that's when you became an activist in the civil rights and anti-war movements.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What brought you back?
Well, I was organizing for a lot of years, like a lot of the rest of us in those movements. And I think we came to a crisis, I know I did, of looking at, you know, what was the foundation for our commitment to social justice? What was a kind of vision that would change our own personal lives? I found the limitations, if you will, of the movement and the left and the student movement and all that. I didn't find enough of the answers there. After those years, I went back to the Bible and read it again with fresh eyes. And I found in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus talks about a whole new order of things that turns the world on its head, our traditional values, turns them upside down. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are those who hunger for justice. Blessed are the peacemakers. Blessed are those who mourn, who have the capacity for grief, who have compassion. Those really were converting words to me. I'd never heard a sermon on the Sermon on the Mount in all my years growing up in the churches. Then I got to Matthew 25, which is my conversion passage, and Jesus says, I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was naked. I was a stranger. I was sick. I was in prison. And you didn't come to see me. You didn't, you weren't there for me. And all the people said, Lord, when do we see you, hungry and thirsty and naked and sick and in prison, and not come to you? And he says, as you've done to the least of these, you've done to me. And that turned a light on in my head. I realized that everything I was learning in the inner city of Detroit and the jungles of Southeast Asia from people who were disenfranchised, on the bottom, who were the victims of our policies, domestic and foreign, that Jesus, in fact, had been with them, among them, and I was learning from them, as Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker, calls Jesus in the distressing disguise of the poor. And so I realized at that point that while I had left the faith and left the church, I really hadn't gotten rid of Jesus. He was there the whole time among the people that were teaching me the most and really opening my eyes and changing the way I looked at life.
You're one of the founders of Sojourners, which is a community of faith. Tell us a little bit about the principles that hold the group together.
Well, Sojourners is a Christian community, and we live in the inner city of Washington, D.C. We are committed to that simple gospel message, that evangel, that good news that Jesus talked about, good news to the poor and good news for all of us. We're committed to a biblical faith. We're committed to peacemaking. We're committed to living with, working with, standing alongside those who are always on the bottom of everybody else's priority list. We deeply believe in community, which means we try and share our lives together. We're committed to each other. We try to make that commitment real. We live very close together in a particular part of the city. We share our resources together. And we believe that we've been called to this. You know, it's not just a job or a sense of career and vocation, but there's a sense of calling. So I think faith is at the heart of it for us.
Jim Wallace is a member of the Sojourners community in Washington, D.C. He's founding editor of Sojourners magazine and author of the new book, The Soul of Politics. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Linda, I guess the Disney History theme park won't be happening.
At least not here in Washington, Terry. One of the things that we'll be looking at is why not, and if not here, then where? We also have, we're covering the news in Haiti, of course, where a grenade was tossed into a crowd of pro-Aristide supporters. There's been some violence in Haiti today. And we're looking at the story of polio. Polio apparently is gone from this hemisphere. Plague, of course, is not, and we're following that story in India. And we'll be talking about the Republican plans for health care.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The young Dutch cellist Peter Vispelvay has been slowly making his mark in both Baroque and classical music, as well as modern. His latest recording is a selection of 6 Vivaldi cello sonatas. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has this review.
Peter Vispelvay has made wonderful recordings of Bach, Beethoven, Brahms, and Benjamin Britten. His latest disc marks a major change. He plays 6 cello sonatas by a composer whose name doesn't begin with B, although 3 of these Vivaldi sonatas may not actually be by Vivaldi. All 6, however, are beautiful, unfamiliar pieces. They give a good cellist an opportunity to be both melancholy and soulful on the one hand, and zippy on the other. Each sonata has four brief movements, alternating slow and fast. Vispelvay rises beautifully to both occasions. Here's the beginning of the first movement of the Sonata No. 5 in E minor, which is real Vivaldi. Vispelvay originally specialized in Baroque music, but he also plays a mean modern cello. His playing here has a warmth and richness usually associated with modern instruments, yet it keeps the refinement and lightness of the Baroque. The sonatas are unusual to us in that the cello is accompanied not by a single keyboard, but by a shifting variety of instruments: guitar, organ, harpsichord, arch lute, theorbo, cello, which may change from movement to movement, or even within movements. The award-winning British ensemble Florilegium accompanies Vispelvay with elegance and restraint in their crucial but subordinate role. If you love Vivaldi's overplayed masterpiece, The Four Seasons, which now has more than 150 recordings, or are tired of it, or both, this disc is a good way to branch out.
Lloyd Schwartz is the Pulitzer Prize-winning classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new album of Vivaldi cello sonatas by Peter Vispelvay on the Channel Classics label. Vispelvay will be performing in the United States next month, with stops in New York and Philadelphia. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Sue Spolin and Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. Sienna Chrisman is our intern. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's the 25th anniversary of Monty Python's Flying Circus. On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate the occasion by featuring interviews with John Cleese, Michael Palin, and Terry Jones. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.